in this speaker, Africa Speaker Series, to the second event of this series. We started this series last semester, and we've had a lot of success with it. Obviously, we want to build on that success, and so this is part of that whole initiative. And I thank you for coming here to this evening. Just a quick introduction of the speaker for this event. Stephen Pierce is currently a lecturer in modern African history at the University of Manchester in England. Before then, he was an assistant professor of history at Tulane University in New Orleans. He managed to get out before Hurricane Katrina. But Stephen Pierce is a very engaging scholar of Northern Nigeria. He's a very prolific writer. He got his doctorate in anthropology and history from the University of Michigan, where I also got my PhD. His monograph, his book, is titled Farmers and the State in Kano, in Colonial Kano, Land Tenure and the Legal Imagination. It was published out of Indiana in 2005, Indiana University Press. Stephen Pierce is also the author of another book titled Discipline and the Other Body, Correction, Corporeality, and Colonialism, which was co-edited with Anupama Rao and published out of Duke University in 2006. He has published articles in several journals, including Interventions, Journal of African History, Comparative Studies in Society and History, Feminist Studies, and other journals. He is currently working on two books, one on the politics of Islamic criminal law in Northern Nigeria in the colonial and post-colonial periods, another one on the moral economy of corruption, which obviously resonates with today's talk. He is also working on a sequel to the Colonialism, Discipline and the Other Body volume. He is working with it with Anupama Rao, with whom he co-edited the other volume. So this is going to be a sequel to that volume, and it's titled Rights and the Human. It is my pleasure to welcome Stephen Pierce.
Well, thank you, Professor Otonu, for the invitation, and to all of you for coming. As you heard, I am trying out on you a set of ideas in a book that I'm in the very early stages of writing. So be patient with me, and I will be very interested to hear your comments and criticisms of what I'm talking about. Well, so Nigeria is famous for being corrupt. I'm sure you've all got the emails. Dearest one, I am Mrs. Mariam Abacha. My husband, the late head of state, General Sani Abacha, who stole about $9 billion from Nigeria while he was head of state for 5 years in the 1990s. Poor Mariam, since she's been widowed, has fallen on hard times. She now has only about $50 million left in Nigeria. She needs your bank account, and if you just give her the information for that account, she'll transfer all that money to you, and then you can share it later. Well, I don't want to disappoint you too much, but those emails didn't come from Mariam. I mean, she's a busy, energetic lady, but she's not sending email to you. The emails really are a very interesting phenomenon. If you go to internet cafes in Nigeria, three quarters of the people you see there will be either looking at porn or sending out these 419 emails. 419 is the section of the Nigerian penal code that outlaws confidence schemes. And so in Nigerian slang, this is called 419 emails. If any of you were foolish enough to reply to one of these emails, you would get responses asking you finally to transfer some money to Nigeria. And if you seemed particularly gullible, you would be encouraged to come to Nigeria along with a lot of money, where you would be robbed at that point. What these sort of confidence people in Nigeria are capitalizing upon, though, is Nigeria's sort of very well-established reputation for being corrupt Everybody in the outside world knows that Nigeria is full of thieves, stealing money from the government, and everybody on the outside world therefore wants to participate in stealing money from Nigeria. This reputation for corruption is not completely undeserved. If you are in Nigeria, you will see corruption going around on around you all the time. There are police checkpoints on rural highways in the middle of cities, and if you want to get through it, you have to give the police a little bit of money. If you want a driver's license, any sort of minor bureaucratic transaction, you'll have to come up with money. If you're an academic doing research and you go to the archives, you gotta pay off the people who work at the archives. Official salaries are very, very low. Officials need to get this money in order to make a living. This isn't the only level at which you see corruption. Public works in Nigeria are all done through contracts. If you want to put up an office building for the government, what the government does is it invites people to make bids on a contract. The contract then goes to the lowest bidder, or not always to the lowest bidder, but somebody with good connections to the government. Usually, that person is just a person like me with no particular expertise in building. And then the contract holder actually sells the contract off to somebody else who actually can build the building. Who makes the money back with tremendous cost overruns. Another sort of corruption. Then again, people who hold government office steal fantastic sums of money, like General Sani Abacha, $9 billion, 5 years. Nigerian corruption is spectacular. It has gotten more and more spectacular since the years in which Nigeria began to establish large-scale oil production in the early 1970s, but it has been notably corrupt ever since the beginning of colonialism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Britain established colonial control over different portions of Nigeria at different dates, but it was basically all under control, colonial control by the first decade of the 20th century. What I would like to suggest to you, though, is that corruption is not just a feature of Nigerian political culture. It isn't something that characterizes Nigeria or Africa. Rather, we have to understand corruption as coming about as the result of a long and very complex set of historical processes in which particular facets of Nigerian political culture got drawn into certain kinds of international systems and systems of understanding, which have resulted in their appearing and in being substantively corrupt. So what I want to do today is to draw out how some of this political culture has existed, how it has changed over time, and how these historical processes have then produced corruption as a way we can describe Nigeria. Now, one of the reasons, I hope this is interesting to you, to the extent it really is that the processes that you see at work in Nigeria are, to a certain extent, analogous to processes we see at work elsewhere in Africa and in other places around the world. By analogy, we can see a more general set of processes at work, and maybe in the question and answer period we can talk about some of the ways in which this can apply elsewhere. But in the interest of trying to be very historically specific, as I trace these long-term historical processes, what I'm going to do is begin by focusing on a very particular area, the northern part of Nigeria, and talk about how its political culture, its political institutions have gotten incorporated into the Nigerian state, and how then that has created corruption as a category. There are analogous arguments that can be made elsewhere in Nigeria, but for the most part, we'll have to talk about that in the Q&A period. I just don't have time to give you the details now. So my frame of reference is going to shift back and forth a little bit. I hope you'll forgive me for that. Now, I've been interested in corruption for a long time. As you heard, for my sins I wrote a book on land tenure, which is not a very interesting topic, I've got to say. But as part of that process of research, I did a long-term field study of a village of about 7,000 people, quite close to the major city of Kano in northern Nigeria. You know, I'm not an idiot. There I was in Nigeria. I was seeing corruption all around me. But as I worked with people living in this village, and I was studying the history of people's farmland and the ways in which they were able to keep access to their farms, I began to hear a whole another set of stories about historical corruption. People told me about court cases, now and in the past, in which the only way it was possible to win was if you bribed the judge enough. Both sides would try to pay the judge money, and the one who paid the most would win. People who went to the village head in order to try to get additional farmland, or with other kinds of petitions, would have to bring the village head presents. Sometimes the village head felt the need for additional money, so he would just go out and he would demand payment from villagers. There was a constant, continuing demand for bribes from these very ordinary peasant farmers. One of my favorite stories about corruption, though, comes from the administration of land tax. Both the pre-colonial period, so the 19th century and even before, and the colonial period, the main form of tax was a tax on farmland, which was levied, at least theoretically, on the basis of the size of farmers' farms. You know, people who had bigger farms were presumably growing more crops, and so they could afford to pay higher levels. Therefore, the colonial government had set up a system in which African officials of the colonial government would come around and they would measure people's farms. These people wanted to be bribed. So what they would do is they would come out and they would survey a farmer's land, and then they would say, okay, how much money are you going to pay me? If you paid a lot of money, they would then make a map of your farm, which was very, very small. If you didn't pay any money, they would make a map, which was very, very big, and then you would have a very large tax bill. As a historian, I was very grateful to the colonial government because they had created this wonderful series of maps, which were extremely good documents of farm holdings in northern Nigeria. The one shortcoming they had was they were completely imaginary. What they really were was a document of a centuries-long process of bribe-giving. You know, Nigeria invented virtual reality long before Western countries did. So there's this very long history of corruption that people saw taking place in Nigeria. But one of the things that struck me about the way in which these peasant farmers were talking about these corrupt processes was they didn't call it corruption. They didn't call the payments they were making bribery. They were all speaking Hausa, so I'm translating the terminology they might have been using into English. Instead, they called these practices oppression. The Hausa word, in case you care, is zalunchi. But they didn't think about it as exceptional. Oppression is the normal way in which government officials deal with people. There's nothing certain but death and taxes in the West. There's nothing certain but zalunchi for peasant farmers living in rural northern Nigeria. It's a very interesting set of problems that my friends in this village talked about. On the one hand, they didn't like being oppressed, but they also recognized that if you were an official, you had a very specific set of obligations. If you have political power, you are expected to have a huge amount of money so that when people who are subordinate to you get into trouble, you can give them help. So if somebody under me has a sick child who needs to go to the hospital, that person can come to me and I can give the child money so that it can get treatment. You know, school fees, divorces, all kinds of things are very expensive for ordinary people can, you can get help to pay those if you have a political patron. And nobody, deserves political power. Nobody would get respect. Nobody could remain in office without having that kind of funding. How do you get that kind of funding? Zalunchi. You have to steal the money. Ultimately, as my friends in this town were talking about Zalunchi, I realized that what it really was a kind of moral discourse. They agreed that Zalunchi was everywhere, but they didn't agree who actually was being oppressive. People who were politically aligned with the village head and sympathetic with him said, oh, no, he only does good things. None of the behavior he engages in is really oppressive. Zalunchi is what those other bad people do. People who politically disagreed with the village head said that he was, in fact, committing Zalunchi. It's a very complicated sort of question, this business of Zalunchi. And this is why I call it a kind of moral economy. It's a set of moral evaluations that people make. And again, maybe this is a topic we can talk about more in the Q&A session. I think that maybe one of the sort of aspects of that makes something Zalunchi or not Zalunchi, makes it oppressive or not oppressive, is its sheer quantity. So people will agree that some sort of minor amount of taking money improperly is okay, but it's possible to cross the line. If I steal $10 from you, you can go along with that. If I steal $1,000, I've gone too far. I'm definitely being oppressive. Certainly one aspect of corruption in Nigeria across the past 40 or so years is that the absolute amounts of cash being stolen seem to be going up and up. Things, for one reason or another, seem to be reaching a crisis point, and so more and more people would agree that things have gone wrong. So, but as I say, people living in this town had this notion that government malpractice was not corruption, that it was oppression. It was not abnormal, epiphenomenal. It was part of the everyday business of government, even if sometimes it was something that was wrong. Now, people with higher levels of education in Nigeria and debates that were more likely to go on in English than in Hausa had more Western-style understandings of corruption. There certainly is a very strong critique of corrupt practices among people in Nigeria, although even there you see certain kinds of ironies. So, for example, I remember one night I was having a beer with a very good friend of mine, a sort of university scholar who for a very, very long time had been extremely eloquent at critiquing corruption in Nigeria and saying, if only we could get some honest people in government, things would be much, much better. This day, however, my friend really quite surprised me by saying that what he would like to do more than anything else is get into some government office so he could begin stealing money and preparing for the future of his children. Barring actually getting office in government, what he wanted to do was to get some big contract so he could steal a lot of money that way. There is this very strong sense among everybody in Nigeria that no matter how good, how well-intentioned the politician, that politician is going to end up being corrupt. So what's wrong? How did we get here? How can we understand corruption? What I'd like to do next is just give you a couple of sort of theoretical approaches for thinking about corruption, particularly corruption in Africa. I'm going to give them to you sort of in very schematic ways. all scholars who actually do write on Nigeria are much more sophisticated than I'm suggesting right now. So I'm going to be unfair. But there is a very strong, there's a very strong tradition for talking about corruption, which follows on the writings of the great sociologist Max Weber. Such theorists suggest that there has been a very important transition from the logic of the pre-modern state to a logic of the modern state. In the pre-modern period, such theorists suggest, states were structured around personalistic ties, say a tie between a king and his subordinates, in which sort of official governmental roles were essentially negotiable ones. When you acted as a government official, in essence what you were doing was negotiating a set of roles that you were playing. You were negotiating that with your overlord. And then, of course, you were also negotiating it with the people under you as well. So in this sort of pre-modern logic, government is this sort of set of very personal ties, and there isn't a set of sort of pre-given principles that explain how the government ought to work. Those of you who know this literature will see that I really am being very unfair to it. Corruption in this sort of approach is something that happens in modern states, but where they deviate. I'm sorry, I told you what the pre-modern state was like. I forgot to tell you about the modern state. What happens is that in the modern state, there is a transition to a much more bureaucratic form of government, where the structure of the government is centered around your whole collections of offices, each of which have very highly determined roles. When you hold one of these offices, you're expected to abide by set codes of behavior, and you should not be deviating from them. You can make decisions within the constitutional logic of your office, but you aren't allowed to deviate from that. Personalistic ties are not supposed to determine how you behave in office. In this way of thinking about things, then corruption is a feature of bureaucratic states that happens when office holders begin to abide not by the logic of bureaucracy, but by a pre-modern logic of personalistic ties. So instead of behaving according to the sort of predetermined code of conduct, you negotiate what you're going to do with the people above you and the people beneath you. So you and what is going on then in Africa, according to this logic, is that Africans are continuing to use sort of traditional forms of political life within the structures of a modern bureaucratic state. There is a mismatch there. Africans are not behaving sort of appropriately, and therefore you have the problem of corruption resulting. So that's one approach to it. It gives you certain kinds of insights into corruption, but a set of scholars emerged a little bit after these sort of neo-Weberian scholars, saying that this actually was not a very good description of processes that were going on in Africa. Such scholars in this school, a much more empiricist school, said that just understanding African society as being a sort of confrontation between modern social forms and pre-modern sort of cultural systems completely misses the sort of dynamic logic that undergirds most of African social, political, and economic life. All of the descriptions we have, say, of African economies demonstrate for us that formal economic indicators like gross national product only cover a part of the total economic activity in African economies. There is, such scholars suggest, a whole complex set of sort of negotiable, political understandings between rulers and ruled, different kinds of office holders, which is much, much more complex than this confrontation between a logic of office and ties of sort of patrons and clients. If there is, corruption in this way of understanding isn't entirely pathological, it's just a different political system. Office holders need to get bribes because they've got concrete needs. Salaries aren't sufficient. Office holders have to make money somehow. Big politicians have to have money to redistribute so that they can appear as sort of men who are worthy of respect. They have to get it from somewhere, therefore they get it from corruption. Corruption is a different way of doing things. That's all. To the extent that corruption is a problem, it's because Africa has had a set of political institutions imposed on it by imperialism. These political systems are not culturally appropriate. Culturally appropriate ones have to be invented. Kind of a romantic picture. It doesn't really manage to capture how problematic corruption is. Nigeria is potentially quite a wealthy country. Most of its oil revenue has ended up in Swiss bank accounts. That's a problem. Let me suggest to you another way of thinking about the problem. I'm ultimately going to try to explain the historical processes that have produced Nigerian corruption. I would like to suggest to you that what is distinctive about the modern state isn't that it's got a set of sort of predetermined offices and a particular sort of rational constitutional logic behind it. Rather, what is distinctive about the modern state is a particular kind of ideology of what the state is. The truth is that these things that we call states are huge collections of individuals, institutions, actors, many of which are quite disparate. The U.S. government, you've got George Bush, Dick Cheney, Nancy Pelosi, the IRS, the Drug Enforcement Administration, many of which have very different social logics, very different interests, and very different ways of behaving. However, we also have an ideology that says that they are all part of this thing we call the state. And they act the way they do because they are part of this rational system that has a very high level logic. So if somebody comes around and says, yes, I'm from the government, you don't make the assumption that this person is making his or her decisions because of indigestion, because of bureaucratic infighting. You think that this person is behaving because this person is doing what he or she is doing because of some pronouncement of the government as a whole. The ideology of the state in this way of thinking is a way in which particular people, institution, actors get legitimacy for their own actions. And having this ideology is then what is sort of unusual, new, and different about modern forms of the state. Ultimately, though, this sort of in this way of understanding, the state is just a label. Now, let me give you the punchline of this talk right now before I go into empirical detail. What I want to suggest to you is that corruption emerges at moments in which people try to use this ideology of the state. I'm not just me, I'm an official. My actions are not just what I want to do, they're state actions. But when that claim also fails, this isn't the way the government should be acting. Something has gone wrong. They try to apply this ideology, it doesn't work. And those are the moments in which we see behavior that people call corruption. Now, northern Nigeria, it's a very interesting place. Up until the beginning of the 19th century, much of northern Nigeria, certainly Hausa-speaking northern Nigeria, was organized in a collection of relatively small city-states. At the beginning of the 19th century, however, there was a huge jihad which conquered these city-states and welded them together into a huge Islamic theocracy, which is generally called today in English the Sokoto Caliphate. It was ruled by a caliph, who's usually called in English the Sultan of Sokoto, and the underneath him there were a set of rulers, usually called emirs in English, who were ruling sort of individual emirates, which corresponded to the pre-jihadic Hausa city-states. If an analogous, if the United States were organized in more or less the same way, city of Nashville and its immediate surroundings might be one particular emirate. And then the emir of Nashville would be ultimately responsible to the Sultan of Washington. Oh, we'll just sort of posit that George Bush is the Sultan of Washington for this. Now, within each one of these emirates, the emir was more or less like a king, but he was assisted in ruling the emirate by a whole hierarchy of subordinate officials, each one of whom had some particular function. So there were office holders who had judicial responsibilities or military responsibilities, people who were responsible for collecting certain kinds of taxes, overseeing marketplaces. The emirate hierarchies were very, very complex. These subordinate officials also played a role in local administration. So the emir and these office holders all lived in the capital city, so in the emirate of Nashville. They'd all be here in Nashville. But then in the little towns out in the surrounding areas, there would be a village head who was in charge of guiding that village. And then one of the members of this sort of hierarchy of officials in the center would be responsible for the administration of some particular town. So let's just posit that Sultan George Bush had appointed Professor Ochonu as Emir of Nashville, let's assume that so Emir Moses decided to appoint the lady in the red T-shirt to some subordinate office. Let's say she's the chief judge of the Emirate of Nashville. One of her responsibilities, in addition to running the court and judging cases, would be territorial administration. So let's say she got territorial responsibilities for Gallatin and Murfreesboro. Towns for which an office holder was responsible weren't necessarily at all close to each other. But the village heads of her villages would be running the villages, and then there would be a messenger, who was usually a slave, who would go back and forth passing messages between the village head and their liege lady. Most of these officials were men. There were a few women who had responsibilities like this. So when taxes were being paid, what would happen is the office holder who had territorial responsibility would talk to the emir and figure out what the general level of taxes would be. Then she would talk to her messengers saying, okay, we need to have Murfreesboro pay $10,000 in taxes. The messenger would then go to the village head, and between the two of them, they would then decide how much tax each one of the individual farmers should be paying. So ultimately, this was extremely negotiable. You notice there are a lot of personalistic ties going on in all of this. This is foreshadowing. So, Emir Moses got appointed as Emir of Nashville, one of the things he would immediately have to do is send a gift to the Sultan of Washington, and then he would also be expected to pay a large amount of tax to Washington, along with other annual presents to be giving to the Sultan in order to demonstrate his continued allegiance. Meanwhile, when he went and appointed various of his subordinate officials, those people also would give gifts to him. And then every year they would also pass amounts of tax up to him. When they were collecting taxes from the different villages for which they had responsibility, they would get the taxes together, retain a portion for themselves so that they could live on it, and then they would pass the rest up to their overlords. In these processes, there would be lots of gift giving back and forth. It's forms of hospitality, forms of kneeling down your allegiance, ways of showing your respect for other people. And of course, any time you went in to try to get, say, a dispute resolved, you would bring a present for the official who was going to help you. It's a way of being respectful. And of course, if you were a lowly person and you needed help, you could always go and say, my sister seems to be possessed by spirits. I need to go to the spirit medium to get her cured. Can you help? And some powerful person might give me some money so that I could try to cure my sister. This system was far from paradise. There was lots of zalunchi going on. It was not, a system that made everybody happy. Nonetheless, it is not a system in which you could really call something very corrupt. Now, colonialism began. The British declared a protectorate over northern Nigeria in 1900. In the area where I study, around Kano, colonialism really came in 1903. Colonialism in northern Nigeria was very weird. The British didn't really want northern Nigeria. They appointed kind of a psycho as the initial governor of Nigeria who wanted to make a reputation. And so against orders, he just went in and annexed the whole territory. The British government didn't want to have to pay any money in order to support the colonial administration. So they wanted revenues from northern Nigeria itself to cover all the costs of government. It still proved to be somewhat expensive, but they simply borrowed money from southern Nigeria. They wanted to make sure that the British taxpayer didn't have to pay much of anything. If you look at the current U.S. imperial adventures in Iraq and the sort of vast unpopularity of using U.S. tax money to reconstruct Iraq, you can see some of the logic there. Taxpayers don't like to have to invest money in a faraway colony. Because they needed to save money, the British didn't install a huge colonial administration. What they did was they retained all of the administrative structures of the pre-colonial Sokoto Caliphate as the main units of administering the country. They replaced certain officials who had declared that they refused to be loyal to Britain, but they kept the structures more or less as is. However, ideologically, they justified colonialism in northern Nigeria, as in much of the rest of Africa, by saying that the pre-colonial systems of government had been unjust, they had been oppressive, they had been major human rights violations, they were a scandal, that demanded European intervention. So it was a little bit problematic then to go in and just retain all of these pre-colonial systems unchanged. This was a paradox. The British said what they were doing was they were retaining these sort of structures of the Sokoto Caliphate, but they were going to improve them. You had to retain them because they were legitimate, and they claimed that Africans were, you know, so primitive they couldn't understand the benefits of modern systems of government. You know, they had to be given their traditional systems, but gradually, over time, they could be modernized and made good and decent. So what the British did was they began to reorganize these administrative systems. One of the first things that freaked them out was this sort of wacky system of local administration, or it was wacky to them, in which these subordinate office holders stayed in the capital and administered very disparate collections of territories. They reorganized the system so that each office holder got responsibility for administering a contiguous district, and then they forced the office holder actually to move out from the capital into a new district capital. And then they got rid of the messenger who was supposed to go back and forth altogether. As this happened, these new district heads collected whole little mini courts around themselves, more or less analogous to the courts surrounding the emirs. So you got a whole sort of extra level of government that got added at this point. I told you that the tax rates had been this highly negotiable system in the pre-colonial period. The British wanted to have a much more rational system. They wanted, though, to retain it, to retain the main tax as being one on farmland. And so they inaugurated the system I described much earlier in the talk, in which farms were going to be measured. Which, as I say, suddenly inaugurated this whole sort of corrupt system around the tax measuring guys. However, with the district heads, a new set of problems had cropped up. In the pre-colonial period, they had made their living in large part by retaining a share of the taxes as they were passing it up the chain of command. Under the new colonial system, however, what they did was they put all of these officials on salaries and then commanded them to pass all of the taxes along. The problem was with the salaries. The salaries were very low, so you couldn't act as a sort of good patron. You weren't able to redistribute enough largesse in order to retain the levels of prestige these office holders had been used to exhibiting. This was a problem all by itself. But the way they set the levels of the salaries was also something of a problem. What happened was that British officers went around and they more or less looked at all of the officials and they decided which ones they liked the most, which one seemed the most tractable, which one seemed the most modern, the most competent, and those were the people who got the high salaries. This did not reflect the indigenous system of prestige very well. And so you had a lot of very disgruntled officials, and you had a number of officials who had very high levels of sort of indigenous prestige and demands upon their own sort of financial resources, but salaries that were completely inadequate to support them. So you had this class of officials plunked down in these new districts. They were desperately short of money, and they suddenly had a whole new administrative infrastructure for monitoring their districts and for extracting money from them. What do you think happened? They began extorting bribes. And the extortion got worse and worse and worse. Corruption emerged from the first moment of the colonial government. And the forms it took I've already described. Ooh, I really am running out of time. As this happened, the systems that had, in the pre-colonial period, protected ordinary people, to some extent, from too great Zalunchi, got moderated somewhat. The Sokoto Caliphate was an Islamic theocracy. There were norms that Islam had for regulating the behavior of government officials. If you violated them, you were being impious. This was a very powerful set of constraints upon officials' behavior. If subordinate officials got too out of line, it was possible for ordinary people to appeal to their superiors on religious grounds. Now, in the colonial period, however, the main way you stayed in office was to keep the British happy with you. The kinds of grassroots pressures that could be put on you no longer functioned. So there was a kind of moderating mechanism that had existed in the pre-colonial period, which no longer did. So officials no longer had as much incentive not to impress people. As that happened, more money began passing through the territory. Cash crops began to be grown, for which people could get internationally convertible currency. People had much more cash in their hands than they ever had before. It was easier then to extort and to steal that cash. And corruption got greater and greater. Basically, the people who were indicted for corruption during the colonial period were ones the British wanted to get rid of for other reasons. Everybody was corrupt to one extent or another. There were probably a few exceptions, but, basically, extortion was the name of the game. You got in trouble for it when somebody above you wanted to get rid of you. This remains true in the post-colonial period. Now, the part of the story that I can't tell you is how this system of local administration using the structures of the pre-colonial Sokoto Caliphate got transferred into the structures of the colonial government and now the post-colonial state. If you want to, I can talk to you some about how that worked in the Q&A period, but it's by itself a long and complicated story. But to conclude, I would like to emphasize to you, corruption isn't some sort of African peculiarity, just something that is an intrinsic part of African life. It is not a failure to modernize, and it's not a colonial imposition. In some ways, there are elements of all of this, but what I hope has become clear over the past 45 minutes or so is that there's a whole set of cultural characteristic, historical processes, historical mistakes, which has made corruption a category of life, which is in some way, it's both a set of concrete processes and a way of understanding what state officials are doing. In the end, we have to understand that corruption comes about when officials, office holders of one sort or another, use their status as being part of the state to act for their own benefit. So they are claiming legitimacy for their status because of this ideology of the state, but people can see that what they are doing is different from what a state official ought to do. There's a category error, and that is what corruption is. This is a contradiction. It is a basic contradiction, and it threatens people's very lives. Money is being stolen from Nigeria. People are starving to death. They are dying of malnutrition. They are being denied medical care. They are being denied a chance at education. There is money that could have provided all of those things, and it is being taken away. Corruption is a real, concrete problem. It comes about, though, because of a set of contradictions. It comes about because of a particular ideology of what a state is going to be. And I strongly suspect that the only resolution we're going to have is having enough time pass for this contradiction somehow to get resolved. Thank you. Well, you're sort of not in the global form I just presented it in. You know, obviously, my remarks come across as a pretty damning indictment of British colonialism, and you know, that really was not anything the British ever came up with by themselves. They certainly did, come to understanding that particular policies were mistaken for one reason or another. But the ways in which they conceptualized those problems tended themselves to be very limited. So, I mean, for example, this policy that I was talking about of retaining indigenous governmental structures as local authorities was called indirect rule. And it became very sort of high prestige policy in British colonialism. When officials wanted to critique one another's policies, what they did was they began accusing those other officials of being direct rulers and not indirect rulers. Direct rule is bad, indirect rule is good. And so you could have a critique in those terms, but it was never a sort of underlying structural one. Yeah.
Well, but they did make a virtue under the Lugard's indirect rule of underrule. That is, rule on the cheap. And Lugard came up with Philip to say, oh, this is great, this is the way we should go. I worked with records in Ghana when indirect rule was imported to the north in the late 20s, 1930s. So you do have this whole system that is set up because you have so damn few people in the field. Even though they had to learn languages, etc. So they did make a virtue of it.
Oh, they made an absolute, they made a virtue of it, although in different places and in different times they sort of changed their mind about what the precise virtues were. So the only thing they really had in common was the label of indirect rule and a certain generalized sense that you had sort of African traditional rulers doing most of the administration. But beyond that, the contents varied wildly over time and place. Yes?
The whole subject of corruption really got into the public discussion in the 1990s. And suddenly it's a very important topic, especially in academia. Now, suppose you studied Anderson auditing or Tycho instead of the community in northern Nigeria. How would that be any different?
No. In essence, I think it is very little different. The primary difference, I'd say, is power. That is, you get called corrupt when you're in society, in a society which doesn't have enough international symbolic capital to avoid being called corrupt. So if you're Sani Abacha and you amass enormous riches, you're corrupt. If you are Dick Cheney and you amass enormous riches, you don't. Or you only get called corrupt very covertly. Certainly there are some concrete distinctions in forms of corruption in different places, but I don't think there is any a priori difference between the two. Between the two. Yeah.
Was there corruption before imposition of colonial rule?
Well, there, there certainly was oppression, in the terminology that, I talked about. in the end, I think it really does depend on, you know, how you want to define corruption. Were officials acting in self-interested ways? Yes, absolutely. Were they somehow acting in violation of what they were expected to be doing? No, not in the same way they were later on. But, you know, I don't know that, you know, what was going on in the pre-colonial period was incredibly more admirable than what was happening in the colonial period. And many people would disagree with me. But were you following up?
Yeah, I was going to say that it seems as if the idea of gift-giving to officials is almost ingrained in the West African system. But I will go further to say it's probably not excessive. It's sort of the token gift.
Right.
Because you are the holder of that office. Now, come to colonial period, you had to make your living out of that office. That's a vast difference.
Well, and... you know, I think that you're getting onto something that is extremely important, although it's very difficult to get a handle on. I mean, that is, the absolute incidence of the money that's being diverted into sort of irregular channels, I think, is going up. Now, in a place like Nigeria, part of the reason that's going on is because Nigeria has gotten so much richer since, you know, 1970. But... you know, this is one of those things, obviously, that is very difficult to measure because, you know, this is illegal activity. But it does certainly look, you know, it does seem to be the case that the absolute incidence of corruption has climbed significantly since 1980. And, you know, even in 1980, you know, Nigerians thought that, you know, the government in power then was spectacularly corrupt. So, you know, as I say, the absolute incidence does seem to be getting larger and larger, although, say, one of the differences that we see is in the pre-colonial period, there wasn't such a hard and fast distinction between sort of public money and private income, you know, and you know, that really came about in the colonial period. Nonetheless, there's still hanky-panky that was going on. Oh, yes.
Yeah, could you propose some policy recommendations? Do you think that it's going to fight corruption? Should that come from a systemic level or individual level?
Well, that, you know, I think one of my difficulties is that, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm much better at telling you how we got to where we are than telling you where we should go from here. It seems to me that what is most likely to be effective in the long term is having, you know, a civil society which is as dynamic as possible, freedom of the press, very strong freedom of information laws, and forums in which critiques of corruption can come to widespread public attention. Policy recommendations. Well, try to make sure that, you know, the Nigerian government and the other governments can't quash freedom of the press, that they are forced to allow public scrutiny of their deliberations. How you actually achieve that is much harder, since particularly corrupt governments are not going to want to get that sort of scrutiny. So in some ways, I'm being fairly disingenuous in saying that this is my main recommendation. I think, very encouraged by not just the continuing dynamism of the press in Nigeria and in many other countries, but also by the proliferation of web blogs and other sort of new media that give much wider groups of people a way of disseminating their opinions widely. And that, I think, may be the biggest boon that we've got for the future. Yes?
Yeah, you were getting on to what I was going to ask, because I was going to ask you, rather than recommending policy, where would you actually see the sort of social and cultural forces from within Nigeria that would generate, you would have the kind of power and influence ability to organize and mobilize in such a way that this could, and we will,
yes, well, and yes, I think, it is exactly there. One of the, if you're talking about Nigeria, where I put my faith is on Nigerians. That is to say, I certainly think anybody who ends up in office probably is going to end up being corrupt to some extent or another. But Nigerians are fantastic journalists. If you want to see a tradition of sort of brilliant political invective, you haven't seen anything until you've seen sort of Nigerian public discourse. And to the extent that Nigerians are able to operate in public forums, they're going to be very, very formidable. And so, I think that, there you've already got the building blocks. Nigerian political society is in many ways actually quite healthy. If you could just get rid of this very unfortunate problem with where the money is going, you'd have one hell of a country.
I wanted to begin from Christoph's question. I want to go back to that. There's actually a more controversial recommendation in terms of policy recommendations. This one is very controversial. It doesn't deny that you need a vibrant press. You need institutional organs that can ask hard questions, that can force public officials to submit themselves to scrutiny. It doesn't deny that. However, it also argues that part of the problem is not that Africans, or Nigerians for that matter, are more corrupt than any other people. As a matter of fact, per capita, there's less corruption in Africa than in the United States. You have a situation where, the WorldCom did not happen in Africa, Enron, of course, did not happen in Africa. So you have this group of scholars who are beginning to say, well, in addition to all these other steps, what might be needed to complement that is to grow this economy, the African economy. Because there's something about the size of the African economy that makes corruption more morally consequential. It's not that there is no corruption in the United States, but it doesn't affect you. It doesn't affect the water, my warm water. I still get my warm water. It doesn't affect my electricity. My electricity doesn't go off. When I go to the hospital, to the Vanderbilt Hospital, I still get attended to in spite of the corruption. So you are never going to get to a point, according to this group of scholars, where you are going to eliminate all corruption, especially since Africans are no more corrupt than any other people. What is required, according to this group of scholars, is, contrary to much of the consensus, to actually put more money. You've heard all this stuff about, don't throw money at the bad situation. You've been giving billions to Africans, and what have they done with it, right? Well, this guy says, throw more money. Come up with a Marshall Fund, even. And grow these economies to the point where corruption doesn't even matter. Because that's what has happened in this country. Grow these economies to the point where if a government official steals, decides to corner the budget of the city council or the state or the district, it doesn't remove medicines from the shelf of hospitals. That road over there doesn't go unconstructed, leading to accidents. It doesn't lead to the water shutting off. It doesn't lead to the electricity going off. So, that's very controversial, obviously, and debatable. But there is that, that school of thought out there.
Well, and actually there's another corollary, and this is also a little bit utopian. To a certain extent, it's not much of a policy recommendation to say, let's make African economies become very wealthy. But one of the other great problems with governmental corruption in Nigeria and elsewhere in Africa is that the state actually does play an absolutely central role in the economy. In many countries, if you want to have a nice middle-class existence, you need to work for the state. There aren't many other jobs that put you on a salary. And one of the ways you can avoid the problem of having all of these office holders who are then sort of diverting money to their own private ends is to have people having concrete economic opportunities that don't depend on state office holding. So now, interestingly enough, there was a policy prescription for Nigeria, which was pioneered in a PhD dissertation from Vanderbilt University, what must be about 25 years ago. We're talking about Nigerian corruption, when in some ways it was less spectacular than now. But his policy prescription was just privatize everything. And if you privatize everything, he said, corruption is going to end. Well, actually, since then, Nigeria has privatized much of what he wanted to privatize, and there's still a lot of corruption. Hasn't worked. What you've really seen is that corruption has moved into the private sector as well. But nonetheless, if you could stop the state from being the central feature of the Nigerian economy and many of the other sort of African economies, that would do a lot to alleviate corruption. But sort of like saying make the economies richer, that's much easier said than done. Yeah.
One way you can start is by raising salaries. One of the moves in Ghana I find interesting is they made substantial raises in salaries, teachers' salaries and other salaries, which seems to have reduced because throughout the whole period, the colonial to the present, as far as Africans were concerned, salaries were very, very low.
Well, and
$70 a month for a lecturer.
Yes.
Buying a book.
Well, and in fact, after Nigeria returned to civilian rule in 1999, President Obasanjo, in fact, has made substantial, he's given substantial raises just across the board in the civil service. And again, now I'm being very sort of touchy-feely and qualitative here, but I am struck by, on the one hand, the way in which the sort of middle-class people I know in Nigeria seem now substantially more comfortable than when I knew them, say, in the mid-1990s, which was sort of at the depths of the Abacha regime when things were really extraordinarily desperate. People, among other things, aren't as noticeably thin as they were back then. But also they've got more cell phones. And they see, they've got a lot more sort of accoutrement of sort of middle-class existence. They seem more comfortable. Nonetheless, when I talk to them about the economic situation, they say that things are worse than in the 1990s. Now, I've not done research where I've tried to work on household budgets or tried to come up with some metric to compare people's economic lives now with their economic lives in the mid-90s. But very impressionistically, I think that the increments in salaries have had a concrete sort of impact on people's material lives, but ideologically, it hasn't had as strong an impact.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
The reception outside, so.
Okay, well, thanks.